Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this debate on Britain and Europe. Tonight's debate is the second in a series organised by the London School of Economics in collaboration with the Times newspaper. Each of these debates is designed to address a major area of public concern. And of course, the debates take place in the run-up to the expected general election. The first debate was held last Wednesday in this theatre, and it focused on issues associated with the Constitution. Two further debates are planned after tonight. One on education, I think that's this Wednesday, and another on the economy. And I'm advised that to obtain tickets, and I'm sure you would wish to rush to these debates, you should consult the LSE website or the Times newspaper. One gives better quality than the other, perhaps. But you can obtain tickets for those debates quite easily. Tonight's debate focuses on the future of Britain in Europe. Of course, we approach the debate, however, with a rather colourful past. Britain is the only member of the European Union to have held a referendum on membership after we joined. Britain has championed opt-outs from the European Union as victories, clearly signalling our concerns about the direction that our partners have wished to take. And today, public opposition to the new European Constitution is as high in the UK, if not higher, than most other European member states. Well, both Europhiles, Eurosceptics seem to agree on one particular aspect. That is, that if only there was more debates, if only there was more information, then the vast majority of the British public would indeed follow their particular line, their position on Europe. And tonight, the main contenders for government have indeed their opportunity of persuading you of their position on Britain in Europe. We have, as you can see, a high-profile panel of speakers. Dennis McShane is the current Minister for Europe. He has served in the Foreign Office in various capacities since the Blair government was first elected in 1997. He was a student at Oxford and then obtained a PhD from the University of London in international economics. He is a former journalist and has been a frequent contributor to newspapers in Germany, France, and the United States. He is the author of several books on international politics, including one, if I remember correctly, on French President François Mitterrand. One can only speculate as to which part of Mitterrand's life Dennis McShane would most likely to emulate, but we'll perhaps discuss that a little later. Graham Brady entered the House of Commons as the youngest Conservative MP in 1997. He is a graduate of Durham University and previously worked at the Centre for Policy Studies. As a Member of Parliament, he has served as a PPS to Michael Ancram and to Michael Howard. He was Shadow Minister for Employment before becoming Shadow Minister for Europe last September. If being the chief spokesman on Europe for the Tory party is fundamentally a character-building exercise, then Graham Brady must indeed be a fairly tough act, and we look forward to his contribution this evening. Sir Mingus Campbell is Shadow Foreign Affairs Spokesman and Deputy Leader of the Liberal Democrats. As a student, he studied law at Glasgow and then at Stanford University. In between being a student, however, he found time to compete in the Tokyo Olympics of 1964 and the Commonwealth Games of 1966. Indeed, he is a former UK record holder for the 100 metres run. One wonders whether he was quite as fast in delivering his student essays whilst at university.
No.
In any event, 2004 seems to have been a very good year for Sir Mingus. In the 1 year, he won three awards as Best Opposition Politician and Best Scottish MP. We have a distinguished panel, and we are very grateful for the support and collaboration with the Times newspaper for this particular event. So please, ladies and gentlemen, welcome our distinguished panel for tonight's debate. The format of the debate is that I'm going to invite each of the speakers to speak for about 10 minutes to give their presentation on their party policy as to how they see the future of Britain in Europe. We will then take questions from the audience, and there should be ample time for that discussion thereafter. We'll follow the listing on your website information rather than the screen behind me, and I'll invite Dennis McShane to open the debate with the presentation on Britain and Europe on behalf of the government. Thank you.
Well, Kevin, thank you very much. I was in my constituency on Saturday handing out hot cross buns in the town centre of Rotherham. You know what we'll do to get a vote these days. And constituent came up to me and said, oh, thank you very much, Dennis. It's very nice. Oh, don't you worry. You'll be voting Labour around here. You'll be all right. But I tell you one thing, Dennis. We're not happy with your policy in Europe. I sort of blinked. He said, no, you know, you'll be all right. You know, we like your work as a Rotherham MP, but you want us to be in Europe, Dennis. And I blinked. He said, no, I've seen you on television, heard you on radio. You do a great job as local MP, but you want us to be in Europe, Dennis. Dennis, we're Yorkshire. We don't want to be in Europe. And I said, I'm sorry, but if you mean by being in Europe the community or now the union, we've been in Europe for 33 years. Oh, have we? They don't give us the facts, do they? So I hope tonight we can have just a little talk about the facts. It's right, as Kevin said, that people do complain that there aren't enough facts about the constitutional treaty available. I do my best, often read in the papers that the government isn't making the case for Europe, and then it's usually a paper to which I have sent a brilliantly worded comment piece article explaining the new constitutional treaty, which they've just refused to publish the day before they complain that we're not making the case for Europe. But this morning with business leaders over breakfast, one of them said that he wished the government would make a positive case for the new treaty. So why is it crucial, so crucial, that we support this new rule book for the European Union? It has the noble name Constitution in it, but it begins the King of the Belgians, the President of the Czech Republic, the Queen of Denmark, and so on and so on, hereby solemnly agree and affirm, and it goes into classic treaty languages, a language. It's not as long as is claimed. It's about between that opening phrase and the signatures of Mr. Blair and Chirac and Schroeder and so forth. It's about 65,000 words, which is 70 pages of The New Statesman, if it's still that long, or The Economist or The Spectator. And then there are lots of declarations and protocols after it. And the very last line in the new treaty is about the use of the word euro in the Latvian and Hungarian languages, with a declaration that the spelling and use of the word euro in the treaty does not in any way affect the rules of Latvian and Hungarian grammar. Now, if there are any Hungarian or Latvian friends here, they might be able to explain to me what this is about. But in essence, we've got a constitution for Europe. We've had one now for a number of years. It is in the treaties, and this is an international treaty. It is signed, negotiated by a government. We've already had one debate and vote in the House of Commons. We'll have another one after the election. And, of course, although I'm not sure how big a theme it will be in the general election, certainly my fellow Labour candidates, Min Campbell's Liberal Democratic candidates, others are standing on a pro-European basis, and Graham will explain that the Conservative Party have a different position. And it'll be up to the voters to decide which MPs they want to send back to the Commons, those in favour of Britain signing, honouring the treaty and ratifying it, and those who have a different position. So if you look at it, it actually is a treaty very much in accordance with British themes, British ideas. Churchill once famously said that we prefer jaw-jaw to war-war, and he was right. But what we've done in recent years is actually develop a new concept called law-law, Kyoto, World Trade Organization, rule of the sea, the European Union, to construct an international legal framework that in this case allows 25 nation states, which frankly for the previous 100 or indeed 1,000 or more years knew much more about how to fight with each other, to grow together. And we do need a legal basis to do that, because it's very easy to turn the clock back and revert to either economic protectionism, not allowing Ryanair and EasyJet to land, or political protectionism, isolating ourselves from our fellow Europeans. But actually, this treaty does make the enlarged EU more manageable. It actually includes, for the first time, an exit clause. So people who don't like Europe can say, here in this treaty, there's now the mechanism to leave the European Union. We didn't have that before. And Alain Lamoussure, the former French politician, a deputy of the National Assembly, a former French Europe minister, who was on the Convention of Europe, he wrote on the 1st of March in Figaro that the debate between federalists on one side and what in French they call souverainistes, what we would call Eurosceptics or nation firsters perhaps, was now finished. He said that was daddy's debate. What now, he says, is that it is not a question, I'm quoting, of replacing 25 states by a European superstate, but of organizing a community of free and sovereign nations. Well, in Britain, alas, we continue to hear what the poet would call the same old lie about a European superstate, even though there's no one on the continent who even thinks, let alone speaks, that dead language. I quote a French politician, because Mr. Lamassoure, like me, is a pro-European, but he knows that neither Paris nor London would support a treaty that threatened the vital interests of our two great nations. And bit by bit, the arguments over a European superstate are falling away. Germany, for example, is campaigning to have its own seat as a permanent member of the UN Security Council. So although you will read in the press stories that under the new treaty, Britain's seat would be abolished, the EU would have a seat on the Security Council, even though the EU can't join the United Nations, what we're actually seeing is evidence that it's going in the other direction of Germany wanting its own national sovereign seat as a permanent member of the Security Council. Can I actually finish my speech and then you can ask the questions you want? I work in a democracy. If the German people elect a government, I assume it speaks for that people. Whether if the German people choose to elect a new government with a new policy, I will respect that. And if you have any respect for democracy, sir, I suggest you do the same. So if you'll let me just carry on. So we have an endless series of wondrous Euro myths to deal with. I read so many of them that the Queen will be abolished. I have a wonderful letter written every month from a lieutenant colonel somewhere in Gloucestershire who says, can I point to that part of the treaty which says the Queen will not have to curtsy to the President of the European Commission? We read that our taxes will be set by Brussels. Our foreign policy will be decided by Brussels. My favourite one, it was the Sun, the Daily Mail, I'm not sure, that the statue of Nelson should be taken off Nelson's column to be replaced by one of Napoleon. Or that under the new treaty, I think it was the Daily Telegraph, it might have been the Daily Mail, Britain could be forced to drive on the right, but out of respect for English traditions, it will be introduced on a staggered basis. Now, when you have to live with this kind of myths and rubbish, repeated regularly in the House of Commons, it is difficult to get the facts over. One of the most oft-repeated canards is that Brussels is responsible for the majority of legislation at Westminster. Well, last week I asked the House of Commons Library, which is like a kind of giant research institution which serves all MPs and parties completely impartially, to examine this figure. They produced a report, I'm happy to send it to anybody who's interested in the details, showing that in the last 5 years, each year, less than 10% of all UK legislation has been based on EU directives and regulations. It's true in some areas, agricultural price fixing, because we have a common policy. Yes, these regulations come from Brussels, the price of sugar or the price of potatoes or whatever. But actually less than 10% of British legislation stems from Brussels. But here I fear I'm drifting into negative defensive lines. So very briefly, let me give you 10 reasons why this treaty is good for Britain. Firstly, it will create, I believe, a more effective European Union. and the European Union of 25 nation states, and all three parties have joint ambitions to see that grow to more, needs new rules to function more effectively. Last year we had 10 new member states joining the EU, and the treaty provides new streamlined procedures and institutions to ensure that the EU continues to be manageable, flexible and effective in the 21st century. In France, they call this constitution La Britannique, because it is a treaty for a Europe of nation states, not a superstate. And the treaty's content has entrenched not just the British view that it's done that, but the view of most other nations that we want a more flexible Europe. The treaty sets out very clearly what Europe does, the institutions of the European Union, the Commission, the Council, the Parliament, and what it doesn't do. Europe will do what we want it to do and what it does best, and what it does best is very important for us all, and countries and regional and devolved assemblies will do what they do best. The treaty does clarify what the EU cannot and cannot do. You require unanimity, or to put it another way, a national veto is retained in key areas like taxation, foreign policy, defence. Fourthly, there's more say for national parliaments. For the first time, we've written into any European treaty a distinct role for national parliaments, so that if a third of EU member parliaments oppose a proposed EU law, they can insist that the European Commission review it. And I think if a third of parliaments say no to something, the Commission would be mad to proceed. That will require new thinking by MPs and other parliamentarians. So we create a network, Europe, of democratic accountability. I support what the European Parliament does. Don't agree with everything, but that doesn't matter. But we actually need 25 parliaments taking part in rendering EU decisions accountable. And that's why the fifth advantage of the treaty is it does make for more open and democratic decision-making. The treaty makes the way the EU makes laws more transparent, more open. In areas where decisions are agreed by majority voting, European laws will have to be approved both by the Council of Ministers, which is made up from ministers from national governments, and by the European Parliament. Tomorrow I fly with Tony Blair to Brussels. He puts up his hand, representing us, you, sir, until he, you know, as long as he's the elected Prime Minister, as Mrs. Thatcher and Mr. Major and Mr. Wilson and Mr. Callaghan did before them, with Mr. Schroeder and Mr. Chirac and Mr. Zapatero, to decide what Europe does. I do it as a representative of a foreign minister, and come the day, perhaps many years to come, that Graham is a Europe minister, he will put up his hand and vote on behalf of Britain, accountable to Parliament. So it's complete nonsense to say, and actually the new treaty underlines the extent to which EU decision-making becomes more transparent, more open. The sixth advantage is, yes, I think it's good that democratically and accountable elected governments set Europe's agenda. We will have a new president or chairman of the European Council, that's the organisation representing all national governments, to ensure a greater coherence of member states' priorities. He will be there alongside, or she, the President of the Commission, the President of Parliament, representing in a sort of the three-pillar format of the European Union, the parliamentary pillar, the Commission pillar, and the nation-states pillar. At the moment, the EU's broad strategy and priorities are set out by the European Council, which is made up of EU heads of government plus the President of the European Commission. At the moment, the presidency of the Council changes every 6 months. It's Luxembourg right now, it's Britain from July through December, then it's Austria and so on and so forth. With 25, 27, 28, 30 members of the EU, that becomes an unmanageable system. So we want a full-time chair of the European Council to represent and give coherence to what the national governments are saying. Seventh advantage, I think we have a much more coherent approach to foreign policy. It was Margaret Thatcher in 1984 who first set out in a famous speech the argument for Europe to have a common foreign policy, not a single foreign policy, not one that obliterates what the national foreign policies of individual countries. We all have a different approach to foreign policy. They say in France that the Quai d'Orsay does foreign policy in poetry. In Britain, we like to think the Foreign Office does foreign policy in plumbing. But between us, we have to now find ways of speaking with one voice. Go and see that film Hotel Rwanda and just remember those shaming moments, not 10 years ago, when British foreign ministers refused to allow the UN to send troops into Rwanda to stop the genocide there, when British foreign ministers sat on their hands and didn't stop the massacre at Srebrenica and until Americans came in, stopped the brutality of Milosevic and the Serbs. We can't afford any longer, in these great days of international difficulties, a Europe of 25 different competing, conflicting foreign policies. So when we agree unanimously a foreign policy, and we'll have a European Union foreign minister, Mr. Solana, representing it, whether it's in the Western Balkans, on Sudan, on Afghanistan, in the Middle East, I welcome that. Still leaves Britain and France and Estonia and Poland, if they want to have other aspects of foreign policy where they may have their own individual perspectives, I welcome that too. But I think the idea of Europe speaking as one, when we agree to speak as one, reinforces the export, if you like, of European democratic values. The new treaty's got a charter of fundamental rights, well worth reading, because these are the classic rights that Britain has fought for and other countries have fought for over hundreds of years. Rights of minorities, rights of religion, the rights not to attack gypsies, the rights not to attack immigrants, the obligation to respect trade unions, the right to found a family, respect for business rights. And I actually think that Charter of Fundamental Rights is a common set of values that says this is what Europe stands for. Yes, it's hedged in by national limits, because in Germany, for example, there are 2 million workers, full-time state employees, who are not allowed under the German constitution to go on strike. So clearly the Germans aren't going to abolish their own constitutional obligations, and the Charter of Fundamental Values is that. It is a statement of what, I'm just about to finish, what Europe believes in. And I think it's well worth reading and something we should support. Finally, the European Commission gets smaller. It's the first international treaty in world history which proposes a reduction of its own bureaucracy, and it's worth supporting for that alone. And then finally, a voting system, I won't go into the details, that is more streamlined, that requires a double majority of both individual governments and the populations they represent to ensure that the decisions Europe takes do actually reflect what people want Europe to do. So those are 10 reasons. I'll put this up on the FCO website tomorrow, so anybody who's studying this can read it there. You don't have to take notes. That I think will actually give us 10 good reasons to vote for this treaty. We won't be having our referendum till next year. We've got our election and the EU presidency to organise this year. But I do say this, that if the rest of Europe votes yes to this new rule book, this new treaty, and Britain alone votes no, it will be a worrying and serious moment in our nation's history. Britain is best when we defeat protectionism, economic protectionism like the Corn Laws or imperial preference, or economic protectionism like the isolation of the 1930s or the failure to intervene in Rwanda or the Balkans in the 1990s. I want my country to be outward looking. I want my country to be confident. I want my country to be shaping Europe, not have decisions imposed on it. To do that, I believe, we should be joining with the best of Britain and the best of Europe in saying yes to this new treaty. Thank you.
And next we have Graham Brady on behalf of the Conservative Party.
Thank you very much, Kevin.
I think they will very soon anyway. Okay.
It's always a great pleasure to debate with Dennis, because we always get these great flights of fancy, the idea of Napoleon on top of Nelson's column, which I haven't even read in The Sun, but Dennis does come out with these wonderful things. I'm not going to do that. I hope I'm going to be a little bit more grounded in the facts. Britain's relationship with the EU, with all of our closest neighbours, is profoundly important to our own people. It's also crucial to the future prosperity and security of continental Europe. That is why, even though we as Conservatives believe the European Union needs very fundamental reform, we believe it would be a mistake for Britain to walk away. Instead, we want Britain to set a new vision, to exert the real leadership in Europe that has been so utterly lacking under the Blair government. Our vision for Europe is very different from that which is currently on offer, but it is also very positive. Only if the EU responds to the challenges facing it in a very different way? Will it have a future as a centre of prosperity and influence? Much good has come out of the closer cooperation of European nations, and there is much that we take for granted in the post-war development of Europe. The freedom to travel in Europe has been an enriching experience for all of us. The fact that our children are able to travel, live, work, study anywhere in Europe gives them great opportunities. And as we get on in life and our bones start to creak, it's easy to see the attraction that has taken hundreds of thousands of our countrymen to live in the sunnier climes of the south of Spain. As a Manchester Member of Parliament, I'm of course constantly amazed there seems to be no corresponding movement in the other direction. The European Union has also played a significant role in guaranteeing democracy, stability and the rule of law, whether in post-Franco Spain or the former Eastern Bloc countries. Others, from Croatia to Turkey and Ukraine, will, we hope, follow in time. The Conservative Party has always been and remains a strong advocate for expansion of the EU. All of that is positive. But there are some very serious problems in the way in which the EU has developed thus far. Problems that would get much worse if the Constitution were ever to come into effect. The first problem is that the political and economic integration of Europe has proceeded in a way that has created a growing disconnection between the people and the institutions of government. Contrary to Dennis McShane, even Gordon Brown admits that the EU now makes 50% of our laws. The 2001 Laeken Declaration, which set up the convention that led to the Constitution, correctly identified the problem that Europe faces when it said, "Europe's citizens want the European institutions to be less unwieldy and rigid, and above all, more efficient and open, that the Union should involve itself more with their particular concerns instead of intervening in every detail in matters by their nature better left to member states. They feel that deals are all too often cut out of their sight, and they want better democratic scrutiny." These were fine words, but the reality remains so very different. We've now seen the EU Court of Auditors refusing to sign off the EU accounts for a 10th successive year. Not a shining example of the better democratic scrutiny talked about at Laeken. But very simply, the electorate here and in other European countries increasingly finds that it has no control over the people who are making decisions affecting their lives. In this country or in any other democracy, if you don't like the government, you can boot it out. With Europe, you can't. This so-called democratic deficit was shown in the clearest terms when Michael Howard unveiled our policy to end uncontrolled immigration, only to be told by Commissioner Frattini that because the Labour government has signed up to parts of a common EU asylum policy, it is no longer possible for Britain to change its policy on which immigrants should be allowed into our country. The Constitution does nothing to resolve this democratic problem that was identified at Laeken. Indeed, by transferring yet more areas to qualified majority voting and through the legally enforceable Charter of Fundamental Rights, the Constitution would make matters much worse. But even for those who have little interest in the democratic process, there is another problem that will confront all of us before too long. There is a growing realization that Europe is failing to rise to the dramatic competitive challenges of the modern world. As the leader in today's FT puts it, this should have been the week when European leaders proudly gathered to undertake their half-term review of the Lisbon Strategy, a grand design to reinvigorate the European Union's economy. Instead, they will meet against the backdrop of failure and discord. Failure to have met most of the Lisbon agenda's multiple goals, failure to observe the budgetary rules of the Stability and Growth Pact, the framework underpinning fiscal policy in the EU, and discord over how to reform either of them. So Britain and the EU have a massive challenge ahead. At current rates, in 20 years' time, the US will still be roughly a quarter of the world economy, and China will be approaching that. By contrast, the EU's share of global trade and GDP will roughly halve over the next few decades. Last week's report from the Treasury projects that the EU will account for a steadily diminishing share of world output, falling from 22% today to 17% by the year 2015, by which date it also predicts that the EU will lose 5 million service sector jobs to offshore suppliers. The three major continental economies already have double-digit unemployment and far worse youth and long-term unemployment than America or Britain. We had all hoped that the single market would solve all these problems. It promised millions of new jobs, a large expansion of trade, faster growth, and higher productivity. But the truth is that Europe's economies grew less in the decade following 1992 than they did in the previous decade. European trade also grew faster in the decade before 1992 than it did in the decade after 1992, unlike trade in North America and in the world generally. The single market has brought benefits, but as yet, it has failed to fulfill its real potential, because it has also been a vehicle for the creation of a vast raft of new regulations that now threatens to stifle Europe's international competitiveness. Again, real deregulation is vital. Not so long ago, these sort of observations would have led to accusations of anti-Europeanism. In fact, Dennis probably will anyway. But today, even the Commission shares our analysis. In 2000, the Lisbon process was going to, I quote, create the world's most competitive knowledge-based economy. For 5 years, the breakthrough was just around the corner. Then, suddenly, the Lisbon promise of being the most competitive global economy was quietly dropped. Last week's report for the Commission, which was elegantly titled The Economic Cost of Non-Lisbon, warned that the failure to implement the Lisbon agenda could cost Europe some £600 billion in lost growth over the coming decade. All of this demonstrates that there is a serious institutional failure to make the EU work as it should. The question is whether that is best tackled by a constitution that centralises more power, enshrines the failed European social model in the law of the member states, and opens the door to judicial activism by the European Court of Justice interpreting the Charter of Fundamental Rights. In other words, something that takes Europe even further in the same direction. I think it was Mr. Becker from Nestle who summed up the great tragedy of the EU constitution brilliantly when he said, "We want more efficient decision-making in Europe, but not if it takes us in the wrong direction more quickly." This is a view that was also put forcefully by Tony Blair's former economic advisor, Derek Scott, when he said the constitution would entrench Europe's economic failure and drag Britain down too. Larkin asked the right questions, but the convention came up with the wrong answer. The constitution is not about reviving Europe's economies or strengthening Europe's democracy. It is another power grab from politicians whose agenda has failed but who will not admit it. The last thing that we need is what Hans-Martin Bury, the German Europe minister, called recently the birth certificate for the United States of Europe. If the EU is to survive as a major centre of world economic activity, we must reject a constitution that spells more movement in the same failed direction. Instead, we must sit down to negotiate a better deal for Britain in a more flexible, less centralised, less regulated Europe. Dennis McShane has said that a no vote would be a crisis for the EU. I disagree. I believe that a no vote, whether it comes from France or Britain, Poland or the Czech Republic, will present an exciting opportunity for Europe. Whatever the momentum that has driven Europe in the direction of ever closer union for the last 50 years, a new approach will be necessary for the next 50 years. The European project is out of date, inward-looking, and inappropriate for today's world. In a phrase coined by the Labour MP Gisela Stewart, this is the problem, it is old men dreaming. No wonder a recent poll found that 18 to 24-year-olds are as deeply opposed to the Constitution as any other age group. They are not Little Englanders. They are not reliving a world war in which their grandfathers were too young to have fought. Young people are not afraid of Europe, but nor are they afraid of the wider world. They travel in Europe and beyond. They want the best of both. And that is our challenge, to take Europe in a new direction that delivers the advantages of free trade and cooperation without the disadvantages of bureaucracy, regulation, high taxes, and loss of democratic freedom. There is nothing new in renegotiation of the EU treaties. It has just been happening. What is new is that a Conservative government will insist on a new direction of travel. Michael Howard set out the framework in his Berlin speech over a year ago. A more open, more flexible Europe. A Europe which is no longer a one-way street towards greater integration. A Europe in which powers can be brought back to Britain and the other member states when it makes sense to do so. a Europe which will regulate less, cost less, and come into conflict less with the desire of our people to run their own affairs. The new EU will be a live and let live Europe. Britain will not always be telling France, Germany, or other more integrationist countries what they must not do. The trade-off is that the other countries will not be able to tell us what we must do either. We will create a flexible Europe in which member states choose to cooperate where it is in their interests. This will be an open, modern, outward-looking forum for free nations to work together. It is a conservative vision for the future of Europe, which will sit easily with the aspirations of younger generations who want to be at ease with Europe, at ease with the wider world, and at the same time to control their own destiny through their own democracies. If we win the election, we will hold a referendum within 6 months, and we will campaign vigorously for a no vote. If we win the referendum, then there will have to be a renegotiation of all the treaties, as there just has been. We will insist on taking back power over certain areas: immigration and asylum, employment law, fishing, and aspects of aid spending. But most important of all, we will establish the principle that powers can be returned to the member states. The conservative vision of Europe fits with a broader picture of global trends and British interests. It would bring government closer to the people, strengthen and enlarge Britain's influence in the world, and allow business across Europe to meet the competitive challenges of the modern world. Empowering citizens and taking back powers from the EU will strengthen the prosperity and security of Britain, Europe, and the world. Mr. Blair thinks that giving more power to an unreformed EU and politicians who can't be voted out is the answer. I think the British people will see there is another, more positive vision for Europe. Following a no vote, the leadership necessary to achieve this vision can only come from a British Conservative government. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. And finally, Sir Mingus Campbell.
The great American Democratic Congressman Mo Udall, who ran unsuccessfully for the nomination of the Democratic Party, was once asked why it was that the convention of the Democratic Party at which a candidate was chosen should last 4 days and not two. And he said, it's really quite simple. He said, after 2 days, everything's been said, but not everyone said it. And in a debate about Europe coming third, I can't help but feel a certain sense of that. I shall try, so far as I can, to restrict myself to the 5 to 10 minutes, which was in our original letter of invitation, because I agree almost entirely with what Dennis McShane has said, and with almost nothing of what Graham Brady has said. I hadn't heard the one about Nelson being at some risk on his column. I suspect he's at rather more risk from Ken Livingstone than he is from Jacques Chirac. I, too, read the Financial Times article. I think read carefully. It's an argument for more rather than less integration, which makes it rather surprising that Graham Brady should find upon it to such an extent as he did. And if this is a centralizing social model Europe, which is enshrined in the document upon which we will all have a chance in due course to vote, then why is it that the French Socialist Party is pretty well ready to reject it on the ground that it's far too committed to the free market and does not sufficiently embody the social market model which they regard as being essential? It's said by Graham Brady and others that a better deal can be obtained for the United Kingdom. Well, as we do in the House of Commons, let me ask the question again. Name a single government out of the other 24 member states of the European Union which is ready to negotiate a better deal with the United Kingdom. Indeed, name a single party of all the parties in the 25 member states of the European Union which is ready to negotiate a better deal other than those parties like UKIP, and as we must now learn to call it Veritas, who actually want Britain to withdraw completely from Europe. So I think this notion that we can move very swiftly to a further renegotiation is one which is not rooted in reality, not least because the convention and the treaty with which we will be concerned in due course took approximately 3.5 years from start to finish. Now, are we to believe that it will be in the interest of Britain or the European Union that a further 3.5 years should be given over to what is effectively navel gazing? Now, the future of Europe will be dominated by the referendum. Of that, there's no doubt. Many people say that the referendum should be concerned about the terms of the treaty itself. And as a principle, how could one object to that? But I think the truth is that any debate about Europe in this country, against the febrile background, in particular, of some of the press coverage, will inevitably be about whether membership is good for us or not. And therefore, those of us who support the European Union will be under obligation to argue for the principle of European Union membership. And that is why, on this occasion, and my two colleagues have heard me do this before, I think that the historical perspective is absolutely essential. Because remember that what we now know as the European Union was born out of the European Coal and Steel Community, a very modest beginning in the early 1950s. And what was its purpose? Its purpose was to avoid the continent of Europe being subjected to the destruction, war, and loss of life that had disfigured Europe 3 times in the preceding 80 years. And the fact is that war between European Union member states is now inconceivable. That is neither incidental nor fortuitous. It is a consequence of the European Union, yes, and of NATO as well. And it's also worth reminding ourselves, having established the case for security out of the European Union, that there's a formidable case for democracy and democratic institutions. I think Graham Brady admitted this, in part at least. Only a few years ago, 8 of the new members of the European Union were satellites of the Soviet Union. And 3 member states, Spain, Portugal, and Greece, were within recent memory dictatorships. And it's inconceivable that those last 3 countries would revert to dictatorships, or indeed that the former Soviet satellites would do anything other than hold on to the principles of democracy and open markets for which they have, in opposition at least, fought for so long. And if you take the Baltic states, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, it is inconceivable, having broken out of the clutches of Nazism and then communism, that they would sign up to an institution and be part of any movement within that institution which had the effect of removing the hard-won freedom which they now enjoy. I think the importance of the European Union lies in terms of prosperity, economic advantage, and inward investment. 750,000, 750,000 Britons, live abroad in European Union member states, and at least 100,000 of them work in the European Union. I accept the case for reform. Europe cannot stand still. It has to enhance its democratic accountability, streamline its powers, and achieve political stability. But this constitution, which is proposed, is a necessary part of that. And let me say this too. In a modern and connected world, affected by globalization, affected by the extraordinary transference of information which takes place on a routine basis, then sovereignty is not preserved by disengagement. It will be undermined by isolation. And it is only with enhanced cooperation in trade and economics that we will achieve our best advantage. And how do we deal with crime, the environment, security, immigration, and the campaign against terrorism unless we are committed to cooperation? It's not a matter of benevolence or it being beneficial. It is imperative. Globalization is not just a matter of opportunities. It's a matter of threats and challenges. So let me, as I promised, try to finish within the time allocated by saying this. Quite right that the accounting procedures of the European Union need to be reformed. It's quite right that the auditors have declined to sign off the accounts for the last 10 years. But why? Because they're not allowed to go into the accounts of the individual states. And if that principle is conceded, then that's a principle of greater integration rather than one of a more loose, less federal arrangement. Another newspaper, not represented here this evening, said on the morning of the debate that we last had in the House of Commons about the Constitution that it was not a document to die for. Well, that seems to me to be a pretty accurate judgment. But it's a document which embodies sensible reform, which is why I'm willing to justify it here, and ultimately too in a referendum of the British people.
Okay, thank you. That's got us off to a very good start. We can take some questions. By prior agreement, we're going to try to bunch three or four together and then have the panel members respond. Let's take the lady over here first, please. There is a microphone when you ask the question. Could I simply ask everyone to ask a question rather than a speech, please?
Yes. Nobody has yet said what the treaty has actually done. I really came here to discover the facts of how the treaty changes what has been, and I'm afraid I'm no wiser now than I was when I arrived, entertaining as the speeches were.
Thank you. The gentleman at the front here, please.
Can I ask, does the proposed European Constitutional Treaty assert the existence of something called European capital, which we might think of as comprised of the physical territories of the present?
Sorry,
and possibly
we didn't catch that on the stage.
European what?
European capital?
Assert the existence of something called European capital, which we can
capital.
Think of as being
capital.
Comprised of the physical territories of present and future members of the EU, along with all the physical, institutional and intellectual instrumentalities that are the product of that land.
Okay.
Does it assert the existence
That's
of a class of persons which we may refer to as citizens of the European Union,
okay,
who are the owners of the thing called European capital?
We're trying to include.
Does it specify in the treaty?
Can you please
the rights and obligations that the class of persons called European citizens have by virtue of their ownership of the thing called European capital? And does it stipulate what measures or what...
Okay, you're going to get a much more brief response if you carry on giving us...
And if it doesn't do any of those things, what use is it?
Fine, thanks. We've got the question.
Have you?
Well, we've heard the question. The gentleman at the back here, please.
I wonder if the members of the panel have heard of the Mandelkern report, which offered member states something like 400 directives which could go back for national legislation, and the member states accepted about 14 of them and left the rest with Brussels so they could blame Brussels for things that would be electorally unpopular at home.
Thank you. One last question in this round. Gentleman here, please. You can say how to be patient for the microphone.
Right. My question's to Graham Brady. In your speech, you spoke first on Britain's right to prevent unlimited migration, and then you said that we couldn't due to a common asylum policy. Don't you think that it's dangerous and irresponsible to confuse the two issues, considering the special status of asylum seekers? And that, yeah, that's basically the question.
Okay, thank you. Thanks. Shall we start with Graham Brady?
Right. Shall I start by pleading guilty? If I had confused asylum and immigration, then I apologise, and you're quite right. The other points that were raised, what does the treaty do? Well, this is something I think that is always a problem. We were asked to speak for about 10 minutes, and of course we are dealing with a vast, stodgy document. And if you get into the detail of it, you do tend to find that people drop off their chairs with boredom very quickly. Some of the key things that the treaty does do, which I object to and which my party objects to, first of all, it asserts as of itself the primacy of EU law over the law of the member states. And Ming can groan, but he knows, as I know, that there is a difference between the primacy of EU law being granted by an act of our parliament, which can be revoked, and the existence of a constitution which asserts that EU law will always have primacy. Secondly, it extends qualified majority voting and extends the competences of what the European Union can do, what it can regulate, into many more areas, 63 areas of qualified majority voting that don't exist at the moment. It builds much further on the development of a common foreign and security policy, and it also establishes the Charter of Fundamental Rights, which Dennis referred to in his remarks, but which, contrary to what the British government set out to achieve in the negotiations in the convention, because they said that it should have the same legal force as the Dandy or the Beano, it was one of Dennis's predecessors who said that, Keith Lowes, in fact, it is legally enforceable. And this opens a whole new field of judicial activism that could have very serious effects into the future in all member states. So in a potted version, those are some of the things that the Constitution seeks to do. The question about European capital, European citizens, and so on, I think the crucial point there, what the Constitution seeks to do is to establish, not in one step, but it seeks to move far further along the road towards European Union having all of the attributes of a state. And it even, which wasn't in your list, but you might want to add it for future occasions, it stipulates that we should all celebrate Europe Day on the 9th of May every year. And I keep tabling questions to Dennis and his colleagues, asking what plans the British government has to celebrate Europe Day, and they keep coming back and saying they have no plans. So if there's a general election on the 5th of May, they've only got 4 days, even if they win the election, to come back and plan their celebrations. So I hope that Dennis is going to get his thinking cap on and work on that. Finally, the point about directives that can go back to the back to the member states, and I hadn't heard of that particular report. But I think that it does give me an opportunity to refer as well to one of the points that Ming made in his comments. There are many European countries and many European parties that see elements of what the European Union does at the moment, which they would like to see returned to national control. And the Dutch Foreign Minister, Bernd Bot, said in a speech he gave, I think last July, he set out a whole list of things that he couldn't see why the EU was responsible for, large parts of the common agricultural policy, roads that don't cross national boundaries, and so on. And also, I spend quite a lot of time talking to friends and colleagues from political parties, many of them from the new member states, who actually are fairly constant in their plea, please make sure that the UK votes no to this constitution, precisely because they want the whole thing reopened, because they think they can get a better deal.
Name me two.
Can we just move on, however, to Seminga's comment?
Well, the Dutch foreign minister disliked this treaty so much that he signed it, which he didn't know what he was signing. Aha.
No, I said it doesn't alter what he said.
No, but what did they say in the Bible? By their works ye shall know them. As for Europe Day, well, in Scotland we celebrate St. Andrew's Day. It doesn't bring about a huge constitutional crisis. Why not? Why not have a day in which we celebrate Europe and the enormous advantages which have been derived from it? And a point perhaps I should have made a little earlier, if Europe is so damaging, potentially, why is it that there are countries queuing up who want to join? Romania and Bulgaria particularly, Croatia, Turkey, and in due course perhaps Montenegro and Serbia. This is an institution that people want to join. If its defects were so manifest, then surely applications for membership would be rather thin on the ground. Primacy of EU law, that's contained in Section 3, I think, or Section 2 of the 1972 Act, which was the Act of Parliament by which the United Kingdom acceded to what was then the European Economic Community. And Graham Brady says there's a distinction to be drawn between something which is granted by Parliament in that way and something which is enshrined in a constitution. That distinction might be capable of being drawn if, however, the Constitution did not provide that you can withdraw if you don't like the Constitution. That is actually a provision of this Constitution which has not previously existed in explicit terms. We have allowed EU law to have primacy in those areas in which the EU operates. It's not a blanket application of primacy. It only has primacy in those areas in which the EU has competencies. And that's why I was disappointed that Graham did not refer to Title I, Part 1 of the treaty, which I shall read to you for your better understanding and elucidation. This constitution establishes the European Union on which member states confer competencies to obtain objectives they have in common. The Union shall coordinate the policies by which the member states aim to achieve these objectives and shall exercise on a community basis the competencies they confer on it. That is to say, the EU only does and is only competent in those areas of activity which the member states expressly confer or invite it to have responsibility for. That seems to me to set out in very clear terms precisely what this document is. And finally, on asylum policy, Graham very generously put his hand up. We're bound, of course, by law. There is a system of law which has primacy over British law when it comes to asylum policy, and it's the United Nations Convention of 1951. And we signed that in 1951. I think there was some fluttering in the Tory party at one stage about withdrawing from the convention. That appears to have gone away. But we are restricted. We have accepted a limitation on our sovereignty so far as it refers to asylum seekers. We have obligations under that convention. These obligations seem to me to be in the best interest of those who seek asylum here, but they're also in the best interest of having this as the kind of country that I, and I suspect many of you, would feel comfortable living in.
Thank you. Dennis McShane.
The first questioner asks a perfectly fair question: what has the treaty done? Well, the treaty doesn't come into force yet until it's ratified. What it will do, what it states, is more power for national parliaments, a clear division of roles, only the competence that member states confer on the Brussels institutions to be carried out, and more power and authority for the elected national governments, because that is the chain of accountability through which Europe has to operate. That's if it's ratified. If it isn't ratified, we have the existing treaties. But the existing treaties are a problem already for some colleagues in Parliament. Mr. John Redwood said that if the Treaty of Amsterdam was adopted, it would bring an end to parliamentary democracy. If the Treaty of Nice was adopted, and I quote, "this would do what Guy Fawkes has failed to do and blow up the British Parliament." Well, Graham and Mig and I are still there, and Mr. Deadwood also is allowed to be a member of the House of Commons. Michael Howard has said, and I'm glad Graham spelt this out, it was very honest of him, he has said that the Conservative government policy is to unilaterally pass laws in the House of Commons saying that Britain is in breach of current, not future, current treaty obligations, social policy, some other policies. That would be possible for the British House of Commons to do. We can put ourselves in breach of any treaty we like, but it would mean Britain being outside the European Union. And the notion that 24 other countries simply hold up their hands and say, "well, thank you very much, Mr. Howard. We didn't understand you didn't want to be part of this thing that we agree to. Of course we accept your conditions." What a jolly good idea, is the most fanciful bit of nonsense I've ever heard in the LSE. And believe me, I've been hearing odd bits of nonsense in the LSE over 35 odd years.
I don't believe it. I don't believe it.
I didn't quite understand the question about European capital, but I'm proud of the fact that, yes, I can be called, I have citizen rights under the European Union. Every one of us now has a right to 4 weeks' holiday, paid holiday a year. We didn't have that before 1997. And if we unilaterally, under the existing treaties, adopt Graham's policy, that right could be thrown out the window because it would cease to be a citizenship right. I'm delighted with the Charter of Fundamental Rights. I'm very happy with the language there
on disability, on respect for religion, respect for communities. I think there's even language calling for respect for Roma and Sinti, and I wouldn't mind seeing a bit of that in British discourse this week. On the idea of withdrawing regulations, yes, I agree. The slight problem is that everybody wants to withdraw different regulations. For example, in France, there are trade unions working for the state-owned airline company that would like to change the rules allowing EasyJet and Ryanair to land anywhere in France, because they think that air travel should be something carried out by protected state airlines. So we're into a what sauce for the goose, what sauce for the gander on this. There are parts of the current EU regulations we certainly need to get right and could be withdrawn. But be very, very careful, because the rights that we want the rest of Europe to respect, environmental rights, crime rights, Kyoto rights, open trade rights, the right to settle, the right to go across borders without endless passport and visa checks, are rights that have to apply to us as well. And on migration and asylum policy, that is difficult, very difficult. I know that as a constituency MP. What Mr. Frattini said was that the only way you can stop asylum seekers coming into the UK is to pull out of the international convention that was signed in 1951 in response to the Holocaust. I think it is the most profoundly shameful policy I've ever heard in my adult life, the call for Britain to resile from that convention, which we helped to shape so that never again would we face what happened in the 1930s. Alas, because of government and European inaction in the 1990s, we faced it in Rwanda, we faced it in Srebrenica. And I hope that Britain is there saying that this, our Europe, doesn't have to be frightened. Last year, we faced the most terrible campaign to stop people from Poland or Hungary or the Czech Republic coming to work in the UK. We faced Mr. David Davis denouncing our policy of having an open border policy on the Today programme, on News at 10, in the House of Commons. We saw headlines in the Daily Mail, pictures of Roma from Slovakia with Union Jacks around their neck, their shoulders, carrying two bags, saying, "I'm on the way." Those Union Jacks were put around their shoulders by British newspaper reporters, because not a single Roma from Slovakia, to my knowledge, has come into the UK. It was one of the most shameful campaigns, xenophobic campaigns, against Poles, Hungarians, Slovakians, Czechs, and others I've ever seen in my life. Today, we have 130,000 workers from Eastern Europe contributing to the British economy, not in the black economy, paying taxes, paying national insurance. Of that 130,000, just 21 are claiming social security benefits. And I call on Graham tonight to apologise to all these people, our friends in Britain, and say that Michael Howard was wrong, David Davis was wrong, the Sun was wrong, the Daily Mail was wrong, and the Tory party will not fight any part of this campaign on any xenophobic, gypsy or any other baiting of East Europeans.
Okay, thank you. We'll take some more questions. The gentleman here. Could you wait for the microphone, please?
My question is to not only one member of parliament, three parties, Labour, Lib Dem and Tory. According to the information, EC law is a supremacy over, prevail over the state laws. There is still confusion that none of the member of parliament clarified that all laws passed by the member states is under the supremacy of EC law. There has been case in 1988.
Okay.
House of Lords. We want to clarify that the supremacy of EC law prevail over the state governments or not.
Okay. Okay. The lady here.
Two questions to Mr. Brady. One, I would like to know, what does the Constitution have to do with the economic problems or the crisis that some countries in continental Europe are having? as you were saying before, because as far as I know, all those problems are could be temporary problems, are related to their domestic policies. And that's why there are other countries such as Great Britain or Spain which are having much more growth and which are having lower deficits or even superavits. And the second question is what type of treaty the Conservatives are envisaging for Europe. It would be kind of a NAFTA agreement with free trade and free capital flows but no free movement of people.
Okay, thank you. The gentleman in the blue here. Yep, behind. Yep.
I would like to ask I would like to ask Mr. Brady about what kind of negotiating power he thinks Britain can have towards the other 24 countries in case they would renegotiate treaties. Because it seems to me to see a story which already happened. In 1957, the Rome Treaty was signed. Britain refused to join it. And for 10 years, they've been asking to enter it, banging on the door, and being left out by De Gaulle. So it's, and they, in this way, they didn't Britain didn't manage to shape European institutions in their own interest and following their own views.
Okay, thanks. Thanks very much. Can we have the gentleman at the front?
I was wondering how hard Dennis McShane thought it would be to enforce countries in breach of the European Convention, and how he felt he could force them to change their minds and say, for example, in the way that France and Germany have breached the Stability and Growth Pact, how he feels that they could Britain could enforce this.
Okay. Can we take the gentleman here in the strike sweatshirt?
Isn't it the case that one of the reasons why proponents of greater EU integration favour it is because they know it allows them to impose laws on the United Kingdom population that they know that could never be mandated through the British ballot box?
Okay. Thanks. We'll go with the panel. Can I ask you to keep to 2 minutes, please? These are big issues, but we also need to have lots of people contributing. Can we start with Smingis Campbell, please?
On the supremacy point, I thought we'd dealt with that. Since 1972, community law has been supreme in those areas, but only those areas in which the EU has competence. What the treaty does is to say that expressly. Prior to that, it was contained in Section 2 of the 1972 Act and was reinforced in the House of Lords case of 1988, to which you referred. The economic problems in the Constitution are quite unrelated, and as well as Spain, you might have pointed to Ireland, which is not only in the EU, but is a member of the single currency, and whose rate of growth is now looked upon with great envy by people in the United Kingdom. What negotiating power for the United Kingdom if we were the only country to say no? Answer, I don't think very much. How do we prevent breaches of the Convention? Well, if there are breaches which are justiciable, capable of being taken to law, then you go to the European Court. On the Stability and Growth Pact, there's been an agreement to modify its terms. I think a lot of people have argued recently, and indeed even from the point, from the time the Stability and Growth Pact was created, that perhaps it imposed too tight a corset, and that in due course there would have to be some flexibility. And on the question of allowing people to impose laws which the public wouldn't accept, then every 4 or 5 years, and perhaps in the next 4 or 5 weeks, the British people get the opportunity to throw out a government which imposes upon them laws or agrees to the imposition of laws which they don't like. There is a democratic check and balance to anything which comes out either of Westminster or of Brussels.
Thank you. Dennis McShane.
Thank you. Primacy was settled in 1972. if you've got time, read the debates in Hansard then. The classic statement was by Quinton Hogg, the Conservative Lord Chancellor, who said that if we join the European Union, we have to accept primacy of EU law in the areas where it is competent. That was also in the White Paper of 1967. It keeps resurfacing, but clearly if we want, for example, France to have to accept British beef after the BSE crisis, it's not accepted by the United States or any Commonwealth country. If we want France to accept British beef, we need a European Court of Justice to impose that. If we want countries to accept Ryanair and EasyJet to land, we have to have a European Court of Justice to enforce that. I did a long speech last Monday at Queen Mary College London to the legal department. It's on the FCO website. Ladies and gentlemen, those of you who have not got much to do tonight can turn to that. The EU Constitution is not about economic policy. I did a dissent from Graham. I make speeches in French and German, write articles urging the French and Germans to review their national economic policy. But many other countries are actually performing even better than the UK. We're the best of the big countries at the moment under Labour. But those are national economic decisions that have to be taken. NAFTA, well, no Mexican lorry driver can drive his lorry with goods from Tijuana to San Francisco. Imagine that Europe where you couldn't drive from Britain to France to Germany without offloading your goods into a French lorry or a German lorry. In 1960, Spain and Mexico had the same GDP per capita. Look at Spain today, thanks to European Union membership. Look at Mexico. And yes, I think there is a bit of the Conservative Party that does think NAFTA is the way forward. I think it's the way back. I like the fact that our goods, our people can move freely across borders without the kind of controls that still exist in North America. Countries that are in breach of agreements, well, there's a negotiation that's happened yesterday and today on that, and that will be reported to the European Council tomorrow. European Union imposing laws that wouldn't be accepted here? Well, I'd like you to name one. What, 4 weeks holiday a year, a European arrest warrant to tackle international crime, common agreement on environmental rules, because last time I checked, air pollution didn't respect national borders. Those are things that we argue for, if you like. And if we want our ideas also to be accepted elsewhere in Europe, then we have to accept, too, that where there's a qualified majority vote in those areas, then we have to accept it. In the key areas, taxation, defence, foreign policy, and the rest, unanimity is required. In other words, we maintain our veto. It means okay. Estonia or Malta can veto us.
Thank you.
That's a big, just a final point, that the UK will have no voice. Norway is not in the EU. You know what they call it? A fax democracy, because Norway actually puts into its law more directives than the UK does. They sit beside the fax machine in Oslo and have to implement EU regulations, and they have to pay hundreds of millions of euros a year for the privilege, as does Switzerland, of trading with Europe. I never want my country to be isolated like that. I want us to be in Europe, shaping Europe, yes, and I'm proud to say okay. Leading Europe in a better direction.
Thanks. Graham Brady.
Within just a few minutes, we've heard Dennis arguing two entirely contrary propositions. First of all, that if we don't have the EU constitution, you'll all lose your rights to 4 weeks paid annual leave.
That's only if the Tories are elected.
And secondly, that this is actually something that we pressed for and would have done anyway. So I think that makes a nonsense of the argument that he's been trying to advance. The question about the primacy of EU law, both of my colleagues have said that the matter was settled in 1972. Well, first of all, if it was settled in 1972, why do we now need to have in the Constitution an assertion of primacy of EU law? It's a consolidation of the existing treaties. It doesn't need to be there asserted as a right in the Constitution. It could be done through the domestic law of all of the member states, as it is in the UK through the European Communities Act. The question of what is allowed under that and whether it's only a matter of things we've decided to give to EU competence, you have to remember the sort of phenomenon of creeping competence that you have in the EU. And a very good example of that, of course, is when the UK had an opt-out from the social chapter, and yet we found that the Working Time Directive was imposed on the United Kingdom against the wishes of the British government at the time under health and safety requirements. So actually it is entirely possible for the European Court to extend that remit. And that's something I think which would happen a lot more with the Charter of Fundamental Rights in place. The question of the relevance of the Constitution to the economic crisis, I think the answer to this really is that the status quo in Europe is not a fixed, steady state. The status quo is a process. It's a process of political and economic integration. And it's a process of political and economic integration which has already put Europe in the position it is today. Some of the things I spoke about earlier, about the relative economic performance of the EU or the United States or of other countries around the world. That is a reality. It's something that if we don't deal with it, if we don't face up to it, we will all suffer, not necessarily in absolute terms, but in relative terms, we will become poorer, whereas others become richer. And the Constitution itself does set in stone a commitment to the European social model. It sets in stone the requirement to cooperate and to have economic cooperation towards certain ends of EU economic policy, which I think all of the evidence to date is that those are policies which have led to failure, not growth and success. And finally, what kind of negotiation power do we have? Well, I think the first thing important to say is that there is precedent in this. We have an EU in which some members are members of the Euro and some are not. We have an EU where some are members of Schengen and some are not. We had a situation where the UK was not a part of the social chapter. And I would argue that was actually the most influential single thing that we did to move the EU towards a more competitive situation. For as long as we stayed out of the social chapter, the EU refrained from bringing forward many proposals under the social chapter. Once Dennis's government foolishly gave up that opt-out from the social chapter, the social chapter requirements started to come forward in larger numbers. But the simple answer is once you have a no vote from any one member state, there has to be a renegotiation, and you cannot find a new treaty settlement without unanimity.
Okay, thanks. We'll take the question from here, please.
In 1997, the Labour Party promised us a referendum on the euro. When are we going to have it?
Okay, thanks. The gentleman in the middle.
Mr. Brady, you are very eloquent in addressing European red tape and inefficiency, but don't you think that it's the European Union and the European Constitution precisely that tries to make the European Union more efficient? And secondly, don't you think that the European Union might be very inefficient at the moment because politicians such as yourself use a national agenda and populism to address your own political agenda?
Okay, thanks. And the gentleman in the blue near the back, please.
Would the panel agree that the EU is being responsible for the destruction of the UK fishing industry? And would you like to talk about shared competences as well as competences as well? And also the regionality, is that going to destroy democracy as well in the EU?
Okay, and the last question here.
Thank you very much. Yes, this is one for Dennis McShane. You started off by talking about the negativities and the knockabout stuff of Napoleon in Trafalgar Square. I wish you would stop doing that because myself and probably a couple of hundred Labour Party members, friends of mine, we're sick of it. Every time we're on the radio, you're doing it. We're writing to the Prime Minister to complain about it because some of us, Dennis, are doing...
Please.
Just a minute, my question is this. Some of us are doing serious work, serious scholarly work, on assessing all sorts of aspects of European unification and so on and so forth, actually. Okay, I'm doing some work on the transparency of the Council of Ministers or not. I listened to your 10 points. They're incredibly thin, but I appreciate in the 10 minutes that you had, you could not be less than thin or more than thin. Okay. What I would like you to do is to publish a paper of about 10,000 words expanding on each of those 10 points so that scholars can assess them properly.
Okay, thanks very much.
Do it. I challenge you to do it.
Thank you. We'll begin with Dennis McShane, but if he could veer towards the 100 words rather than 10,000.
2 minutes.
I'd appreciate that.
Well, there's a 5,000-word speech on the website. And if you look at all of my speeches, you want to write to me, sir, I will send you all sorts of material that goes to all of this.
Papers.
Okay. He's threatening you with speeches.
Yes, he's not. You're not reading for a PhD.
I'm very happy, sir, to send you my properly researched papers. If they don't meet your scholarly requirements, I mean, my life's ambition has always been to be a footnote in somebody's thesis, and I believe it's about to take shape tonight. On the referendum on the euro, the answer is when the economic conditions are right. And that simply is it. It's an economic question. The government doesn't think the economic conditions are right, so we're not talking about a referendum on that. On the fishing industry of Europe, from the Atlantic coastline of Europe, frankly, from Portugal right up to the North Sea, it's been devastating for every fishing community. Any of us who live, I think I heard a Spanish colleague somebody earlier on, anybody from France would know just what wrenching difficulties there have been. What I would say is that if Britain pulls out of the EU, then we will have no voice or shape or say at all in trying to get any hope for any part of our fishing communities. I speak with a family background in that. Populism, well, I suppose all politicians have to try and be popular, Graham, so I'm not going to accuse you of that. All I have to say is, this is a closed meeting. I know there are this is a secret. I don't want any of this to go out anywhere. When the Conservative Party start becoming pro-European again, they might win an election. Graham, every one of your points was from the Labour Party's campaign textbook, 1983. Then we called it the longest suicide note in history, but you're a young guy, and one day you're going to see sense of Europe.
Graham Brady. Well,
Dennis is too kind, but
he's offering you a suicide note.
At least he'd write the suicide note for me, whereas he won't write the document the gentleman up there wants. But the simple fact is that, of course, in 1983, the Labour Party was advocating withdrawal from Europe. I was very clear that isn't our position. What we want is a different kind of European Union. We believe that British leadership to that end will be good for Britain and good for the European Union. On the Euro referendum, very interesting question, because of course some of these things do disappear. We've even had a bill before the House of Commons supposedly to implement the Constitution, and we were allowed a second reading debate on the 9th of February, and now 6-7 weeks later we still haven't had committee stage. It's just disappeared, and the government doesn't always bring these things forward. But of course Dennis, when he was speaking on a famous occasion to my old university, Durham, he referred to the euro, and he said that, of course, the economic tests were just a giant red herring.
Well,
it was all on tape,
yeah,
actually. And I heard it, and it may be that it is that it is today as well.
He
then went on to say, I think, to the New Statesman, that the whole thing was an economic irrelevance. But of course, that wasn't what they said when they were promising the referendum on the euro. Would the EU be more efficient if only we had more of it? Would it be better if only more decision-making was centralised and it was all done further away from the people? No, I don't believe it would. And I think we've had a process of more centralisation in the EU over decades, and it's landed us where we are now, which is not the most competitive place in the world. So I think that's one reason why it would be wrong to go in that direction. The other is a very simple reason, that I think it is important that we have more democracy and that decisions are taken closer to people, not further away. So more centralisation and more central decision-making in the EU is a thoroughly bad thing. The UK fishing industry, well, I'm delighted that Dennis agrees that the common fisheries policy has devastated, in his words, the British fishing industry. It has, and it is a disgrace. But if he looks at some other countries, if he looks at what Iceland has done in terms of establishing national and regional control over fisheries. If he looks, obviously much further afield, but at what happens in the Falkland Islands, if he looks even at the Mediterranean, which where they're outside the CFP mechanism, they have successful management of fisheries, and there's no earthly reason why we couldn't do the same. Shared competences. Yes, I think this is a crucial point. Of course, what the Constitution does is say that anything that isn't set out as something which is reserved to the member states should be a shared competence, and that means that the EU has some control over it. And the final point was about regions. And I think there was a serious danger of that, we might have seen a growing regionalisation of government in this country, and that might have played to the agenda of those who want a quote-unquote Europe of the regions. But I think that was probably paid to very clearly and decisively by the no vote in the North East referendum a couple of months ago, by nearly 80% of the people voting against it. And I hope we'll have the same result when we have a referendum on the Constitution.
I see there's about 30 seconds to go, so I'll deal with populism and negativity. I'm wondering whether it is populist to say I'm against negativity. And I'll confine my remarks to the European referendum. I'll tell you when we'll have a referendum on the euro, on the single currency, after Gordon Brown ceases to be Prime Minister.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. Indeed, we must come to a conclusion. On your behalf, I'd like to thank our three panellists for their contributions. I'd like to thank you on the whole for your questions as well. And thank you for coming to this debate. A further one will be this Wednesday in the theatre. Thank you very much.
God me, is this the beginning of an eternal roadshow?
I know, I'm going to send my camera.